This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
Due to the graphic nature of this killer's crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes dramatizations and discussions of murder and assault that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for children under 13. Now, enjoy the show.
Hello?
Lee.
Hey, I meant to call you early, but I just...
What the hell is going on, Lee? They've been up to my parents again. They got to my sister with questions. I don't know what the hell is going on.
Huh?
Lee.
Why are they asking your sister questions?
I don't know. Lee, they're coming after me. I know they are.
No, they're not. Honey, listen.
No. My mom is a nervous wreck. I'm crying all the time, and I just
don't... Listen to me. Do what you gotta do, okay?
I'm gonna have to. Because I can't go to jail for something you did. This isn't fair.
I'm not letting you go to jail, okay? That's not gonna happen. I won't let it happen.
How?
I have to confess. Ty, I love you.
Do it now. Get it over with.
Do what?
Confess.
Confess? Now? To you? Ty, you already know everything. I don't understand.
Just do it.
Ty, are you taping this?
I love you, Lee.
Ty, what are you doing?
I really loved you.
Impulsive, violent, psychopathic, serial killer. On October 9th, 2002, Eileen Wuornos became the 10th woman in history to be executed in the United States. Guilty of committing 7 murders over the course of a year, Wuornos is, to this day, one of the biggest and most infamous serial killers in our culture. Hi, I'm Greg Polson, and this is Serial Killers, a new podcast diving into the minds and motives of serial killers. This week, our subject is Eileen Wuornos, one of the most infamous and notorious female serial murderers. If you want to listen to any episodes of Serial Killers, you can find them all on your favorite podcast directory. Don't forget to subscribe. You can also listen on our website, parcast.com, spelled parcast.com. A new episode comes out every Monday. Visit our Facebook page, Parcast, to join the conversation.
I am as guilty as can be.
While Eileen was by no means the first female serial killer, she was labeled as such by the media. Her eventual arrest and time spent in custody provided officials with a wealth of information that influences the way that we think about female serial killers to this day. From November 1989 to December 1990, a string of 7 murders of middle-aged white men took place in Central Florida. The men were shot at point-blank range with the same gun, a .22 caliber.
She killed 7 men in cold blood. She didn't premeditate the individual killings. She had a pattern, and she took targets of opportunity.
In January 1991, 35-year-old Eileen Warnos was arrested at a bar. Her ex-lover, a woman named Tyra Moore, made a deal with the authorities. She was going to get Eileen to confess in exchange for immunity.
Yeah, and I got to come clean that I killed those seven men in first-degree murder and robbery. As they said, they had it right. A serial killer. Not so much like thrill kill. I was into the robbing biz. I mean, you know, serial killers are in this thrill killing jazz. I was into the robbing, just and eliminate a witness. But still, then again, I got a number, so it's serial killer.
This was part of Eileen's confession, days after her conviction. But how did the police find Eileen? Why was she a suspect? And most importantly, how did Eileen find herself in that position in the first place? To better understand the mind of a woman responsible for so many deaths, we need to take a look at her life. And to join me on this ride, Vanessa. Vanessa will be answering questions I have about the mental makeup of a serial killer, what makes them tick, what molded them, and what their thought process is like. It is important to note that she's not a psychologist or psychiatrist, but like me, she's fascinated by the psychology of serial killers and has done a lot of research for this show. Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Greg.
Before we start talking about Eileen Warnos specifically, I want to ask you about the profiling of female serial killers. One of every six serial killers is said to be female. It's a much lower number than male serial killers, of course. Is it true that for a while, women weren't even considered to fit the serial killer profile by criminal psychologists?
Yes, and that's a big mistake. A lot of murder cases took a long time to be solved because investigators simply wouldn't even consider the fact that a woman could have done it. They were not seen as being capable of serial murder or of being predators in the way we know serial killers to be. For a long time, their propensity for this type of violence was simply underestimated, which is a fascinating thing in and of itself.
Can you give us just a glimpse of the main differences between male serial killers and female serial killers?
Absolutely. One of the things that fascinates me is motive. While most murders by male serial killers tend to involve sex in some way, they're usually associated with desire for male domination, control, humiliation, and sadistic sexual violence. Women are more likely to kill for money or power.
Could you expand a little more on that?
There is a school of thought that links the differences between male and female serial killers to their reproductive potential. Women have limited reproductive potential, which makes obtaining resources more important to them. Men, on the other hand, are likely to take far more sexual partners, as their reproductive potential is almost infinite.
Which brings us back to Eileen Warnos in a way. One could argue that she embodies qualities of both the male and female serial killer profiles.
Yes, there was a great deal of sex, or at least the mention of sex on Eileen's part, and she used it to select her victims. But Eileen herself said that she killed because she needed the money.
We're getting ahead of ourselves here. Let's start from the beginning. Eileen was born on February 29th, 1956, in Rochester, Michigan, just a few miles from Detroit. Her mother, Diane Warnos, married Eileen's father, Leo Pittman, when she was only 14 years old. Diane was 16 when Eileen was born. By that time, Leo had enlisted in the army to escape prison and was no longer in the picture. When Eileen was 2 years old, she was left in the care of her grandparents. Diane did that twice in less than a year. On the second time, she didn't come back to claim her kids. That marked the beginning of a very troubled life. Eileen was raised by her grandparents as their own daughter. Up until the age of 10, she was not aware that her mother was actually her grandmother, that some of her siblings were actually her aunts and uncles. Her grandfather, Lori, was a raging alcoholic who beat them up constantly. Eileen herself started drinking at an early age. She and her biological brother, Keith, had sexual intercourse with each other multiple times before the age of 11. By the time she turned 11, she was having sex with the neighborhood kids in exchange for cigarettes. Once she learned she could make what she would call good money out of that, she began prostituting herself at age 13. We've discussed the influences that an environment has on shaping a serial killer. Do you think the same can be said about family members?
Absolutely. Eileen's father was also convicted of a capital crime. He abducted a 7-year-old from school, drove her across state lines, sexually abused her, and returned her to the same place he picked her up. Even though he wasn't given the death penalty, he hung himself in 1969. Eileen and her father never met.
But if they never met, how could that still have influenced Eileen?
Great question. A study focused on a group of sociopaths who were adopted as infants showed that the biological relatives of sociopaths were 4 to 5 times more likely to be one than the average person. I'm not saying there's a specific criminal gene, of course. You're not a criminal by nature. But it is safe to say that there is a predisposition towards the propensity for it once it's in your family history.
Basically, she sabotaged every friendship she had because other kids were afraid of Eileen. She would have this extraordinary explosion from time to time, much to the embarrassment of sister slash aunt Laurie, who really tried to do things to stand up for Eileen, but at times it became impossible and unbearable. Barry was a bit older and was out of the house, so Laurie was more in the thick of it. But it was very tough because Eileen clearly longed for these connections, but just was unable to rein in this sort of these demons inside her long enough to sustain anything.
Eileen's explosive behavior had legal consequences way before her string of murders. She was arrested a few times for disorderly conduct and was wanted for grand larceny.
She was also in and out of the hospital for attempted suicide, especially after her brother Keith died of esophageal cancer. They took care of her physically, but she received minimum counseling.
In the spring of 1986, after a 9-week failed marriage to a man 40 years her senior, 30-year-old Eileen met a person she would constantly refer to as the love of her life. Her name was Tyra Moore. The two met at a bar and shortly moved in together. She had finally found someone to connect with.
It wasn't really a sexual relationship. Tyra was, for Eileen, the companion she always longed for. Serial killers usually come from families that are dysfunctional and debilitating. They don't get close to many people. Tyra got closer to Eileen than anyone else in her life had ever bothered to. Many people are quick to label her as a man-hating lesbian, but there's no evidence to suggest that. She had loving relationships with men. It just so happened to be that the love of her life was a woman.
She took care of Tyra. She used her prostitution money to support her and convinced her girlfriend to stick around. Eileen finally had the stability she always wanted. But at some point, something changed. Eileen committed her first murder. What led to it?
You can call those events trigger events. They don't have to be a big deal, actually. We're not necessarily talking about someone close to them dying or immense loss of income. For Eileen, it was the idea of her stability being destroyed.
Which brings us to Thanksgiving, 1989. Tyra invited a friend for dinner, and Eileen became extremely uncomfortable. She was jealous. She didn't talk to the woman at any time. Eileen believed Tyra was in love with someone else. She thought she was going to leave her.
That was the result of her low self-esteem. She had a life filled with abandonment, filled with people who wouldn't accept her. She was terribly insecure, and there was reason to believe that the thought of Tyra leaving her was what triggered Eileen into killing her first victim. They were both struggling financially, and Eileen's jealousy of Tyra interacting with other people at work prevented her from finding a job. So Eileen decided to become the sole provider for the couple, still working as a prostitute.
And you have a woman who's been prostituting herself for over 10 years, living off cheap beer and drugs. She wasn't classically the most attractive woman to begin with. There wasn't a lot of demand for her, so the money wasn't coming in.
Our story will continue in a moment after a brief message.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times.
Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And now, back to serial killers.
And that's when robbing became the answer and a motivation to kill. She would target her victims and figure out how much money they were carrying when she pretended to hitchhike. Her first victim was 51-year-old electric store owner Richard Mallory.
Hey, going where?
Daytona. Got room for one?
Hop in.
Thanks, man.
You've been on the road for long?
Excuse me?
Well, I'm just saying you look cold. How long were you on the road before you found a ride?
Oh, it was nothing. Just a couple of hours.
Jesus. Do you need to warm up?
Look, man, I do this for a living. If you want to, it's $40.
Calm down. I was going to offer you alcohol to warm up. Vodka and orange juice. I have it in the back seat.
Oh, okay. Thanks.
You say you do this for a living? And you're not talking about hitchhiking, are you? $40?
Yeah, $40. Advanced.
Yeah, I got it.
You got a lot more than 40 there.
Going to a bachelor party. Had to come prepared. You ever been to those?
How much you got there? Like, $300?
Around that, yeah.
I'm trying to get to my kids. Here, look at them.
Hey, I don't want to look at your kids. I mean, don't get me wrong, but we're about to, you know.
Yeah, that's fine.
Now let's do this quick if we want to get to dinner.
After shooting Richard Mallory 4 times and stealing all of his money, Warnos wrapped his body in a blanket, cleaned up any traces of her actions, and drove off with his car to meet Tyra. Tyra later said,
"She had told me that she had killed someone, and I didn't believe her. Because of the way she talked about it, I didn't think she had it in her, really."
They abandoned the car a few days later after removing everything of value from it. They cleaned up evidence of the murder and covered the vehicle with sand. The police found the car the next day. 2 weeks later, they found Mallory's body. But they had no leads on the killer. And Tyra?
She stayed with Eileen. She knew her girlfriend had committed first-degree murder and had stolen her victim's car. And still, she didn't go to the police. She said,
"I thought at that time that, okay, she has all the frustration out of her system. For whatever reason, she hated society, that she'll be okay." But obviously she wasn't. Obviously it was just the turning point, and she figured she got away with it once, she would keep doing it.
6 months later, Eileen found her second victim, and her third, and her fourth. She went on a killing spree in a very short period of time. She robbed and killed David Spears, Charles Cascadon, and Peter Symes. She shot them all at point-blank range and stole their money to show off to Tyra. Apparently, Eileen felt like she still needed to prove to her girlfriend that she was still able to provide for both of them.
Notably, this happened near a time Tyra's sister came to visit. She wanted Tyra to go back to Ohio. Her family missed her, and they had everything already set up for her if she decided to move back. And that scared Eileen once more.
"I don't understand where this is coming from."
"It's nothing."
"It ain't nothing. You're talking about leaving, destroying everything."
"I didn't say it was going, did I? Besides, maybe it would be good for us."
good for us.
Lee, calm down. I was just saying.
No. Do I not provide for you? Make you feel safe? Everything I do, Ty. Everything is for us.
I know that.
Don't you think I love you?
Of course. Don't be stupid.
You're the one talking about packing up.
I didn't mean it. I love you. I want to be with you. Just forget about it.
A few weeks later, she killed David Spears, a construction worker. His body was found on June 1st, 1990, buried in the woods, shot at point-blank range, and wrapped up in a blanket. Very similar to Eileen's first kill.
Which makes us believe that there is a pattern in her actions.
Out of that spirals a life of incredible resentment, frustration, and rage. And who does she kill? She kills her father over and over and over again. The police say we don't know how many men she killed. She kept killing the same guy. We don't know what triggered it off, but it wouldn't take a Sigmund Freud to try to figure out the relationship between her and her father. And to look at these middle-aged, white men, sort of business types, who must have epitomized to her everything that she hated in this culture.
Here's an excerpt from one of Eileen's testimonies in court. Here she talks about her first victim, Richard Mallory.
He put the cord around my neck, and he said, "Yes, you are, bitch." He said, "You're gonna do everything I tell you to do. And if you don't, I'll kill you right now, and I'll f*** you after. Like, just like the other sluts I've done."
She's talking about acting in self-defense. That all seven of the murders she committed were a result of being violated in said victims' cars. She was on I-95 day and night, selling her body to an array of strangers. Some of the people she had sex with were violent towards her.
But there is no evidence to support the belief that that specific story is true.
Even though Richard Mallory spent 10 years in prison himself for being a sex offender, Eileen only came forward with the rape story months after she was apprehended. Chances are she learned about Mallory's past, and her defense team decided to use it as evidence that she had been raped in order to claim self-defense.
You have to take into consideration the fact that Mallory's body was found fully clothed. He had been shot from the passenger seat. He was buried and wrapped in a rug. His pockets were empty. She shot him point blank and took the time to bury his body and clean up the crime scene, when she could have gone to the police right away to claim self-defense. She didn't, because the rape most likely never happened.
When you take into consideration the fact that she walked around with a gun and Windex, the argument of self-defense becomes ever tougher to stand by. Investigators would later refer to it as her kill bag. Sure, you can say the gun might have been for protection, but Windex? That's something you use to clean up the scene of a crime. The kill bag was what convinced the jury that it was all premeditated. She left her home ready to kill and ready to clean the scene of the crime, no matter who the victim ended up being. Her testimony had a lot of specific details about the use of force on Richard Mallory's end.
It was a story that changed a lot during the entire prosecution. Let's not forget, she was a woman who lived her whole life around moments of sexual abuse. She was hopping in cars with strangers who knew she was going to offer them sex in exchange for money. That by itself is a pretty violent setting.
There were also cases of people who got away from Eileen before she could do anything. Stories of people who offered her rides, or even stopped for sex. But lucky enough, her extreme and intense behavior scared them off.
One of those men who agreed to give her a ride was so scared of her after 10 minutes of the trip that he stopped at a gas station, gave her money to buy cigarettes, and said he was going to wait in the car. As soon as she stepped out, he drove away.
Let's get back a little bit and talk about the rape accusations, which were the base for Eileen's defense. It's important to remember her victims had families. Wives, sons, daughters, brothers and sisters. She was not only responsible for ending their lives, but she also tried to destroy their memories, to taint the victim's history after they were dead, just for a chance to reduce her punishment.
There wasn't any sex involved in my dad's murder. They cut him, they did an autopsy on my dad. They wouldn't release his body for over a week. They cut him from stem to stern. There wasn't any semen there, anywhere.
Just cannot imagine the grief, the hurt, the anguish that they have caused. This family, this is a man that I had for 50.
I hope she meets up with, quote, old Sparky. You know who old Sparky is.
Eileen was a psychopath. Over the past century, a test has been adapted and perfected. We call it the PCLR, which stands for the Psychopathy Checklist Revised. It's comprised of a checklist of 20 perceived psychopathic traits, each of which is then scored on a 3-point scale. The cutoff score for psychopathy in the United States is 30. Eileen scored 32. In addition to having that label applied to her, Eileen also suffered from borderline personality disorder and antisocial personality disorder.
So it's an indisputable fact that Eileen's brain was incapable of functioning the way yours or mine does. Even though Eileen's behavior diverged from the norm, it also had its appeal. The media portrayal of Eileen was fascinating to viewers. That, combined with the fact that she was a woman, in what was known as a man's business, earned her sympathy from the audience.
She was a homosexual sex worker. She was abused by a number of members of her family, and she suffered emotional abuse by every person she trusted.
So you would understand how she could have been seen as an underdog.
And she believed it herself. She believed that the system had wronged her, which isn't entirely untrue. She had a very unfortunate upbringing that, had there been court intervention, may have led to the growth of a completely different individual. She'd been through a lot, and because of that, she genuinely thought she was going to be absolved of her crimes, as if that somehow gave her carte blanche to kill. She was not expecting to get the sentence she received.
Listen to her reaction when she was given the death penalty, and then come to your conclusions.
I sentence you to death for the murder of Charles Humphreys. Case number 91-112, Citrus County case number. I sentence you to death for the murder of David Spears.
Thank you. And probably see, I'll be up in heaven while y'all rotting in hell.
Okay, there will be an automatic appeal. You have the right to an appeal. Mr. Glazer, is that going to be handled by you or the public defender?
May your wife and kids get raped.
I would ask that you would point the public defender's office.
I know I was raped. You weren't nothing but a bunch of scum.
Therefore, these proceedings are now
completed. Putting somebody who was raped to death?
Mr. Glazer,
Mr.
Glazer,
Mr.
There is no reason to believe that Eileen only killed 7 people. Out of those, she couldn't remember where she buried one of the bodies, saying she was too drunk that day. There's also no proof that Eileen's murders topped that number. And even to this day, it's possible that we'll never actually know.
She didn't pick her victims and plan ahead. She saw the opportunities when she needed, and she took them.
Our story will continue in a moment, right after the break.
Now, our story continues.
A lot of us tend to think of a serial killer as an organized person, maybe because those are the movies we see. They usually choose stories about killers who study their victims, plan ahead, and follow a pattern. Where does Eileen fit in all that?
She certainly fits the profile of what we call a disorganized killer. Her victims happen to be people who were in the wrong place at the wrong time during a very brief period of time. There was no planning on the specificity of the victim. She also fits the visionary killer definition. Those are people who are usually psychotic, who pick their victims at random, whose kills are geographically concentrated with an objective in mind, which, in Eileen's case, was to get money.
Can you talk a little more about organized killers versus disorganized killers? Where did that term come from?
It's a term that came from the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which defines 3 distinct types of serial killers based on the way they carry out their murders: medical, organized, and disorganized. Of course, it's not an exact science, and there have been concerns about simplifying those people too much to fit into a pigeonhole, because crossovers and mixed killers do happen.
And what are the characteristics that would indicate in which category someone would fall?
Well, you have the medical killer, who is a rarity, but there have been some people who have become involved in the medical industry just to carry out their killing needs. And it's harder to catch those, because you have patients dying in hospitals on a daily basis. Why would you think someone was murdered, for example? Those killers are extremely intelligent, and they know how to cover their tracks. They're also one of the more common types of female serial killers. As serial killers tend to play on stereotypes to blend in, it's been seen that female killers take on roles with stereotypical feminine connotations, nursing or teaching. It gave them access to vulnerable people, potential victims.
And the organized and disorganized?
Organized killers are very difficult to catch as well. They usually have an above-average IQ. They plan ahead on every aspect of the kill, from the victims to the weapon and location. They're meticulous. Even though most of the time they target strangers, they want to prove to the law that they're better and smarter than them. And the so-called disorganized killer has the qualities I mentioned before. They're impulsive. They don't usually plan ahead. They're usually socially inadequate, so they are easier to catch.
Eileen's story is certainly an interesting one, and only serves to be filled with more intrigue once she's able to start telling it herself. But how was she caught? What took place over the 12 years between that moment and her eventual death by lethal injection? Those are all good questions, and we're going to answer them next week as we delve further into the mind of Eileen Wuornos. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Serial Killers. We'll be back next Monday to conclude the story of the life and death of Eileen Wuornos, one of the most notorious female killers in history. Don't forget to subscribe to Serial Killers on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Google Play, or any other podcast directory. Or through our website, parcast.com. That's parcast.com. A new episode of Serial Killers comes out every Monday. Please let us know what you think and join the conversation on our Parcast Facebook page. You can tweet us at Parcast Network. That's Parcast Network. And as always, we thank you for listening. Have a killer week. Serial Killers was created by Max Cutler and developed by Ron Cutler. It is a production of Cutler Media and is part of the Parcast Network. It's produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Ron Shapiro, with production assistance by Joel Stein and Maggie Admire. Serial Killers is written by Paula Sabaga and stars Greg Polson and Vanessa Richardson. The amazing cast of voice actors includes, by alphabetical order, Wendy McKenzie and Stephen Pinto.